This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1018, Book of the Month Club, the original Spider-Man clone saga. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Chapman. This is episode 1018. It's a Book of the Month Club. We haven't done one of these in a long time. This time it's about the original Spider-Man clone saga. I'm joined by two good friends, Paul Scores and Nathan Struck. And I'll jump right into the episode in a second, which has a nice little dramatic opening from Paul Scores. But before we do, just wanted to mention again, you can email me at the show at comicshenanigans@gmail.com, rate the show on iTunes, subscribe to us on iTunes or really Apple Podcasts, and listen to us on the Spotify. Upcoming episodes in the next couple of months, we're going to have Judd Winnick back on the show. Mike Rockwitz is going to be joining the show. We're going to have Tom Brevoort coming back for a second, well, not even a second, I guess a fourth engagement, technically. So a lot of fun and exciting stuff coming up in upcoming episodes. So you'll have to, stay tuned for that. Without further ado, let's jump right into the episode where I break down the original Spider-Man clone saga with two good friends, Paul Scores and Nathan Struck. Enjoy.
Behold, the beginning of the saga of spider clones. On a crisp November evening, three intrepid spider bros look to dive deep into the mystery, nuance, and spectacle of a story at the time had no idea how it would impact the comic industry nearly two decades later. Hang on, true believers, as this new era begins of side tangents, vintage vocabulary, and rediscovery. Where will the conversation take us? You'll have to listen in order to find out. Comic Shenanigans is proud to present the original Clone Saga as part of our Book of the Month Club series, Excelsior.
That was an excellent intro by my co-host, Paul Scores. I'm also joined by Nathan Struck, and we are doing Book of the Month Clubs once again, but this time we're going to be consistent, because the last time we did one of these was 10 years ago. We did two of them, and then it never happened again. So we're going to be doing, for the next year, we're going to be talking about the Clone Saga in depth to ad nauseum, and we're going to really get our hands deep in clones. That sounded so much worse than I thought. And today we are starting with the original Clone Saga, specifically issues Amazing Spider-Man 139 to 151. First of all, before we even get started, welcome, boys. How are you feeling about talking about Clone Saga for the next year?
I'm breathing in. I'm inhaling for a long period of time, just trying to soak that thought in. I mean, we have good intentions, and we hope that we will. I think we do. We hope that we'll fulfill this quest. I'm down. I'm excited, and it's much more interesting to me than reading on my own. And I had started reading it again months ago and stopped, and so being able to look forward to talk with you guys about it, I think will make it more just overall enjoyable and nostalgic and fun for me.
Yeah, I guess for the listeners who've been along for the journey, on this podcast, know that we're all big Clone Saga guys. We'll always remember it fondly, right? So could it go back and see if it stands up and if it's, as fun as you remember it to be. And look, I remember very specific parts of the Clone Saga very well. I think those will stand up. I'm sure there's some blips in there like, oh my God, this was very 90s or very what it is. So, But where we're starting today is a whole new level of territory, because it's nothing I've ever read before. Both in terms of Spider-Man mythos and comics of that era, which I know is probably your leading question, Mr. Chapman, so I won't go too far on a tangent here. But I'm very looking forward to kind of diving deep back into this age of clones and going into it.
I've made no secret of my love of 90s comics in general and Spider-Man clones stuff in particular. So this will be a lot of fun to be able to talk about this with you guys. Now, today, it was really fun for me to kind of see and hopefully to see what you guys think of the 70s Spider-Man, because it's something I read a long time ago. My first exposure to the Clone Saga was actually probably, I want to say 96, 97, because one of the first trade paperbacks I ever bought was called Spider-Man Clone Genesis, and it had 141 to 151 of Amazing Spider-Man in it, and it was the original Clone Saga. And I knew of the Clone Saga because my friend had been reading Spider-Man comics. I didn't really buy them during the Clone Saga, which is kind of weird looking back that I didn't really experience it in real time as much as other people, because I wasn't buying it myself. And I kind of started buying right after the Clone Saga, but then also went back to kind of read as much as I could. But then I read the 70s stuff. So, you know, the issues 141 to 151 are very indelible to me and really imprinted upon my psyche. I remember them so clearly because I was still a young reader in my informative state, kind of taking in all this information and understanding continuity and putting it all together. Like, I knew Danny Burkhart because of this story, and I don't think he ever really shows up in many places. And the people are like, who's Danny Burkhart? He's a Mysterio? What? But I remembered it because of this weird collection of stories. Nowadays, it's collected in two other formats. You can read it in the Spider-Man the Original Clone Saga, which is what Nate has in front of him today, which has 139 to 150 of Amazing Spider-Man, plus a lot of ancillary stuff we're not going to talk about specifically today, about Carrion, etc., which happens much later in Spectacular Spider-Man. And then this year, they published the Amazing Spider-Man Epic Collection, Volume 9, which collects 143 to 164. So this has more of the meat of the actual original Clone Saga, plus the previous volume, which was called Man-Wolf at Midnight, which is quite a title, has the, you know, those earlier issues as well. So you guys have never really experienced this version of Marvel, and this you've read some 70s stuff, but not never Spider-Man. So Nate, what was your first impression of reading 70s Spider-Man?
I really enjoy the colors. I think something about this era and the colorists, and they're not all, it's not the same colors from chapter to chapter or issue to issue, rather. Their names are different, and of course the styles are different, but I don't know, really intense, you know, purple skylines and, you know, juxtaposed yellows and deep shadows and you know, popping off the page red. So the colors really were nice. I enjoyed that about them. I think that Ross Andrew grew on me as an artist over time. I think, you know, he had a nice kind of vertigo sense, almost inspired verticality to his, a lot of his panels and stuff like that. And then he just seems to, like, loosen up, too, like, a little bit stiff as I'm reading him in, like, 139. And, you know, once we get to, like, France, I feel like he's finding his feet, if he hadn't, you know, I don't know how long he was on the series at one before 139, but so the art grew on me, but there's something, you talked a lot about the whimsy of this era and how you appreciate it, and it's about cornball-y stuff, and that I can appreciate. I'm fine with that. I mean, I read 70s X-Men, and it's also got its own fair share of, like, weird stuff. But I'm not a huge fan of the new villains. I really, really enjoy the Sinister Six or the Ditko villains getting brought back in. I love Mysterio coming in, and to a lesser extent, maybe Scorpion, but some of those familiar faces, I'm not as keen on the Jackal prancing around in what appears to be a suit of a Jackal, green kind of goblin creature with green undies. I don't really understand it. And the Grizzly, who kind of starts off this collection, don't care, right? It's just like a worse version of the Rhino. So I don't know. I'm kind of down on this. I think sometimes I really enjoy it, and other times, I don't know. It just feels like it's spinning its wheels. But overall, I think we want to tell you. I think I did enjoy it more than I thought I would.
Did you find, like, as I said, as you got more used to it and more kind of the nomenclature of the time and kind of the pacing, et cetera, did you find that as you progressed to the end of the storyline or the end of issue 151, that it did kind of pick up for you and maybe you just got more used to the charm of the time, or did you find it just kind of plateaued and just kind of stayed there?
Yeah, the Mysterio stuff is really the Danny or Daniel Burkhardt is really an apex for me. That's kind of a crest. I like the stuff with Mary Jane and Gwen, even though I don't like what happens to those women. I don't like how they're treated in the story.
Hmm.
And the art, or at least the colors, not persistently, but at almost every issue, Ross, Andrew, or the colorists, you know, put together a series of panels, or maybe just even one panel that's kind of breathtaking, especially in the four color separations.
Hmm.
I'm looking at some of these panels of France. And so that's almost enough to kind of get me through the stuff I find is paced a little bit clunky. Tons of exposition, of course, but that's to be expected in this era. I'm still struggling with trying to appreciate comics when I don't feel the writer appreciates the artist. And to be fair to them, based on the context, a lot of writers were still, almost like reeling or responding to the Jim Steranko of it all. When Jim, infamously wrote a silent issue or silent pages in an issue of Nick Fury initial, and he was told he only gets half a paycheck. He doesn't get his pencils and his writing check because you didn't write anything, you just drew. And unless you put words on the page, you can't be paid to be a writer. And so to some extent, they are protecting their job by filling the page with words. And it gives the letter something to do. But as we see in the late 80s and then certainly in the early 90s with, writers like Alan Moore, there's a lot more trust and emphasis on silent panels and storytelling. And so I think Ross Andrew is doing some pretty cool storytelling here, but, it's the old, and Stan would do this to Jack all the time. He would have someone being thrown through a window and then Spider-Man declaring, oh no, he's being thrown through a window. So there's like a lot of that absolutely unnecessary. A picture is worth 1,000 words. You didn't need to waste words. And so I've always, there's a tension with me, right? I want to just kind of let my eyes dance around a page. Mm. Like how I read modern comics is I think, I don't remember who it was, maybe Larry Hama, who kind of encouraged this kind of thing of like, look at the page, scan the page. Unlike European comics, which tend to be a little more formulaic, there's a culture in American comics of the shape of the panel. So the panels themselves can tell a story. They can draw your eye, allow the page to tell you something, and then kind of go panel by panel and really play in the gutters and the timing and the spacing. Whereas there's also an anxiety to me where I'm almost fighting my education, my learning with reading prose, which is just like, get the information, scan it left to right, go down, read the words, focus on the words. Those are the primary thing. And don't skip any words, right? It's so ironic that so often my eyes will almost quickly glance across a panel and take in briefly the image and just go right to the bubbles, get right to the narrative boxes or get right to the word bubbles. Because I, as a kid and to adulthood, words, look at the text. And so I've talked to people who have been reading comics while we're chatting or something. And I've kind of like seen that, engaged in that, someone prioritizing all these boxes, and then they're finished with the page and they turn it over. And I might comment and go, wow, I really like the colors there. Or weren't the shadows just like so evocative as I point kind of over their shoulder? And sheepishly they go, oh, I didn't notice. I didn't look at that. Right? Like I've talked to people who have read comics almost despite the images. And I feel I'm still kind of doing that sometimes. I don't take the images in enough. And I skip images over words. Where this time around, I tried to kind of stop that. I went, I don't have to read everything. So often, right, that the artist is being ignored or marginalized by the author because the author, the writer, is describing what they're drawing anyway. So that's been a kind of a battle in my head about how to move through these spaces, in the fancy languages, multimodalities. Comics are a multimodality medium where you have two modes at least, right, of meaning. So that was, maybe this is way more than you want me to say at this point about what my experience was. That was what I was trying to do. I was trying to like appreciate the 70s-ness of the comic, but also not slow down and trudge through the text in expense of the images.
Interesting. Before I move on to Paul, it does, you mentioned how at times, I guess, you know, 60s, 70s writers especially, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of words on the page, and sometimes there doesn't need to be. And they can hold, they could hold back, but they choose not to. But then you do have moments, like in Amazing Spider-Man 143, where Peter actually, where he goes to the airport, and he's about to leave with Robbie, and he has that moment with MJ, and they have their that really beautifully illustrated first kiss. And then there's a scene where they're kind of awkwardly saying goodbye for a moment, and then he just kind of leaves, and then you have a full page, which at the time would have been a lot of real estate, to basically have no dialogue. There's just her kind of saying, far freaking out, just walking away, but just having this quieter moment and letting the art tell the story. And the only real, I guess, letters on the page are the sounds of the of the plane taking off. So you do have moments where Conway is able to just lean into what Andrew is giving him.
Great page. Really good page.
Oh, yeah, it's gorgeous. And again, coming back to your idea about the colors, I find often the limitations of the colorists lead to a lot more inventive choices. In older comics, and I find in general there's a warmth to the older comics that I really enjoy, and I find modern coloring techniques at times are overly complicated without necessarily being as complex as the original color processes, where they had to do a lot more with a lot less.
Oh yeah, the mood in 143, right, of the intense yellows on the city streets at night with that kind of, I don't know, not a cyan blue, but soft kind of cyan. Mm-hmm. And then the moon, right, constantly reflecting almost the orangey setting sun, perhaps, in the background, over the canals and stuff. Like, just really, really evocative sense of place. And Marvel's, of course, praised for positioning Manhattan as a true sense of place, real authentic buildings, right, artists who lived there. Ross Andrew really did his research. Like, there's no internet, right? Like, these are clippings or pictures or images or atlases or encyclopedias he's gone to. And these aren't flat kind of buildings or front-facing buildings. He's got low angle kind of camera tilted up with Dutch angle tilts. Like, he's really playing with the positionality of the camera, so to speak, in a place that most American readers will have, no familiarity with Paris, and it really feels lived in. It's so lush and real, and so that's very memorable to me. I don't care about Cyclone. I don't care about Cyclone until the Thunderbolts, right? In the 90s, where he appears, right, with Busick's Thunderbolts. But the cityscape is great, and the rooftops. So there's enough of a feeling to many of these pages where I almost enjoy this collection just flipping through it more than I enjoy reading it.
I mean, I would say, and the idea about, you prefer the more classic villains as opposed to some of the more modern creations of the time. What I find is interesting about this collection, and I promise I'm going to get to you, Paul, in a second. What I do find really interesting is that at times, it's obviously part of this, the Peter Parker soap opera. But what I miss about this type of era is that the world that Peter inhabits feels more lived in. The supporting characters feel like they have things going on. They're not just servicing Peter's plot. There's you have subplots building, like the idea that, Peter thinks he sees Gwen, and that's a running subplot. Originally, we think it's just because of the Mysterio stuff, but maybe it's something else. Then we see Aunt May sees this person, the silhouette, which is a gorgeous shot when we just see the silhouette in front of Aunt May's house right before she kind of...
Incredible.
And it's an incredible, like, I don't even know how you make the colors do that. But it's this beautiful image. So I liked how, at times the villain stuff almost felt like it was, not that it was unnecessary, but it wasn't what I was necessarily there for. I was there for what next is happening in this world of these people. Like, JJ has stuff to do. Like, he's got shit going on. And he's given more, room to evolve or devolve at times as a character. And so I found that really interesting to see how the world is for Peter, because I lament that, especially, when JMS took over Spider-Man, it was a great thing for the quality of storytelling, but he didn't really do much with the supporting cast, if anything. You had Peter, MJ, and May, and that was pretty much it for most of it. He really wasn't worried about the grander world.
And Ezekiel.
Well, and Ezekiel, his own character, yeah. But you know what I mean? Like, there wasn't an ongoing, that's the page with Gwen. you don't see in more modern comics, you don't, first of all, subplots are not really a thing of the past anymore because no one knows when they're going to be on a book till before they have to leave. So you see less and less of these kind of dangling subplots that where writers have the leeway to seed stories and have the security of knowing I'm still going to be around to do something with this and to give supporting cast actually things to do and have their own storylines. Ned and Betty are going to get married. They're having their own thing. Like, you know, unfortunately, that does not go well for either of them. But at least here, it seems more, you know, this is you're watching a life lived. And I appreciate that about reading these stories.
And it has that energy of college life of being, you know, trying to get your dates in line and your paper finished and get to class and you've got a part-time job and your boss doesn't appreciate you. So the time period in Peter's life really fits that chaotic energy. And when he moves out of college, I just feel like it's never quite the same, right? Because he's a married man, he's a family man, and yet he still has like a crappy job and he's still kind of doing all these kind of trappings of almost a childhood that he's kind of locked into, his, you know, perpetual childhood.
I guess it's the idea that he seems less sad when he's a kid dealing with these things.
Yes.
But when when it's an adult, you're like, can't you get your shit together? Like it without meaning to, but you do start to feel that way. They're like, other heroes seem to get their shit together better. Why can't Peter do it? He's pretty smart.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't. Yeah. Speaking of which, like, again, like maybe we'll get to it, but the way that the clone of Gwen is treated, especially before he realizes or is told that, right. He freaks out and says, you must be an imposter. And I get that. Like, okay, fine. Super villain of the week all the time or the month, constantly throwing things in front of you. There are Mysterios in the world, but you know, once that seems to be that eliminated as an option or as a possibility, just wretched to her, especially with that, again, that coming back to that page of Aunt May seeing Gwen in the snow, and it's the dialogue bubble, the word bubble is just that girl. That girl. And it makes me think of later what you know, Scott Pilgrim, right? How that's kind of how Ramona is depicted, walking in the snow one day, that girl, just like this. I know that's not how May is phrasing it here, but when I look at that page though, there's something about Gwen in the kind of the moonlight or like the street light, her hands in her pockets, she's got her boots on, and for fans of the character, for all these people who have seen maybe Gwen as the perfect girl or this girlfriend they wish they could have, I don't know. There's just something so perfect about that panel, and I kind of wish that there was more of a space for the Gwen clone not to go through the Marvel, which kind of starts here, I suppose. The Marvel heritage of clone characters get written into storylines, they get treated like crap, they die or get dismissed, and then there's a whole narrative about how they're not really people, a nothing girl in a nowhere place, right? For Madeline Pryor. And then Ben's the same way. And this Gwen clone, same thing. They're not real people. They don't have real emotions. They don't deserve personhood. They're not, you know, worthy of moral consideration. And it's kind of, I know that they're plot devices. I know they're walking plot devices. The clone is a cue for drama, right? I mean, this is right out of a soap opera. And, you know, the whole thing about Inferno, what happens to Madeline Pryor, like, she's literally by editorial fiat being told, Chris Claremont, you write this character out. And so she's screaming, I'm a real person, acknowledge me, to the readers, as the readers are being told, no, this isn't, no, never mind, don't look at what this other hand is doing, we're being told to get rid of her. So I get that there's a whole metatextual thing here, but it's hard to kind of, to see for the characters that I like and love, especially like Ben Reilly, who gets treated later, kind of dismissed and thrown in the bin. And so I suppose that all kind of starts here, right? There's something, mm-hmm. You said, what was my time like reading this? That's my takeaway. When Peter goes and drops the body off in the smokestack, my heart breaks a little bit because I have a completely different perspective than readers who would at the time, right? I'm thinking that's my boy. It's not, but I'm thinking that's my boy. And then even this Gwen clone, I mean, I'm not a huge Gwen fan, but my heart breaks for the Gwen. I read more comics of the Gwen clones, plural, right, than ever of the original. And so I have some kind of affinity to that. I think it might be, if I'm going to psychoanalyze myself, being a second, a younger brother, always being player two, always being Luigi. There's something about the clone, about the copy, about the not quite player one that might appeal to me. But I'm going on here. Hold on. I'm sorry about that.
Paul, we've said so much, but we haven't actually heard from you yet. So you've probably read even less 70s comics than Nate, because Nate's read like 70s X-Men, etc. But your intake of 70s comics, I would imagine, would be very little, if any. So what was your feeling coming into this world? Like, this is a world you've seen referenced because you've read the Clone Saga. You've seen them reference these types of stories. Mm-hmm. But now you actually experienced these stories. So what was your interpretation?
Yeah, it's like opening a history book to a certain degree. I remember only reading the Dark Phoenix saga recently, right, only knowing it from the cartoon from X-Men. So reading this, my first kind of feeling reading it was almost like, it wasn't my favorite show, but I watched my fair share of it, but it was like reading the old Spidey cartoon. Right, like, mm-hmm. I felt like it was very much in that world, in that vein, in that, you know, pacing and narrative. Every issue kind of felt like a self-contained episode to a certain degree, with some underlying stuff kind of interlaced in between, but also like very, very sporadic. Like, you have, you know, two issues where he's fighting the big grizzly dude, and then we immediately move on to him driving around in his spider buggy in the streets for no apparent reason, yeah, being chased by the cops. And then suddenly, you know, the Scorpion is in Aunt May's hospital room trying to kill her. And it's like all these random, non-connected things, you know, and there's always seems to be a very convenient thing or a convenient villain that's giving a place at the right time every single way you turn, right? Like, you know, I had to laugh a bit, because I think in our big group chat, Nate had shown the panel of, you know, Mysterio running across eight buildings to double punch Spidey, and here it is in this book. I didn't realize I was going to actually read that. I don't know if Nate, I guess with his recent reading of it, that's where it came into play, or it's going to be a total fluke. But I don't. I laughed really hard when I saw that. Like, oh my god, this is exactly where that thing is from, right? So that was kind of fun to see. It's interesting, the art varied at the time, obviously. But it wasn't like bad. Like, it was very, it makes sense of the time. I didn't flip through any book going, ooh, this is like rough to get through. Like, I had a hard time with some more modern or some 90s comics to get through some of it because of the art being nasty. But this is actually was quite pleasant to get through for the most part, very consistent all the way throughout, which helps the tones. I was surprised at times. Like, I can understand, like, all the, you know, Nate touched on this a little bit when he was going on about, you know, the sexualization of the female characters, and I guess that, you know, the guys are all older and everyone has cigars, and, like, you know, very of the time. So that's easy to understand or relate to, so you don't, you know, take it too seriously, because, like, that's just what it was. But there's some, like, interactions and some things that Peter do. Like, there's one scene where I think it's in the annual, before he goes to Florida to fight the man thing, right? And he swings down as one random bystander is giving him a hard time, and he practically, like, smashes him down with, like, hand in his face, and almost, you know, threatens to fight this guy who's chirping him, right? I gotta watch this TV and go to Orlando and fight the man thing. Screw off, buddy. Like, it was such a weird, like, who is this guy, right? Like, who's this jerk face Peter Parker or Spider-Man? That felt very out of character, I guess, for what I would ever know Peter to be, especially, you know, back in the day. I felt he was more, not quite Superman Boy Scout-y, but I wouldn't foresee him being a jerk like that to a random bystander. Like, to Jonah, sure, but to some random guy on the street, I don't know. Maybe, you know, and, you know, seeing him, you know, chased by the police as viciously as he was, like that one cop who, you know, they get him off the boat. Oh, don't take his mask off. It's going to be worth millions. I'm going to be chief of police. You know, that was kind of weird beat there. But the one that shocked me the most, I think, was it's kind of two different ways. I like the scene from a perspective of, you know, we have, like, the superhero culture right now, like, it's a big, huge thing right now, and you see all these superhero origin stories happen, right? And you have these people who are, you know, regular people like you and me, who are thrust into this life of heroism and death and destruction and chaos and all these things. And, you know, we live in this world of now of mental health and stability and how that really affects someone if you really think about it, right? If suddenly, like, even something as cheesy and campy as, like, the Power Rangers, here's these teenagers who are now forced to become this fighting force against aliens from space who really want to destroy the world. Like, if you really think about it, it's a crazy concept to even think of, right? So to have Peter here on the steps and have kind of like the shadow of Spider-Man saying, hey, Peter, you finally lost your marbles, it kind of all makes sense. Here's this guy who's been through so much, being a superhero, has had his woman thrown off the bridge, and now here she is in front of him. But then for him to also then turn and snap and say, do you want me to punch you in your pretty mouth? Like, whoa, where does that come from? So like, it makes sense, but it's also, oh my God, I can't believe Peter would ever say that either. So it was kind of a, you know, and maybe that was the point of that particular line, that was kind of crazy to see him kind of go crazy and like, you know, he feels it's this villain's trying to mess with his brain with this clone, the initial thing. So you can read into it, but again, a very shocking kind of reaction to it. Which, again, makes a ton of sense if you really dive into the psyche part of it, which I found very fascinating. Especially, like, you know, something being written kind of right then and there, right? And you see this poor clone of Gwen who's just, like, she has almost no idea what's going on, where she's come from. As far as she knows, no time's gone by, and she's, like, floored that her lover is about to punch her in the mouth and would threaten such a crazy thing. It's quite fascinating. I do agree at times when, you know, their narration's literally telling you what's happening on the panel is unnecessary, but there are also times where it's kind of expanding on it. And I do appreciate that, and I do find sometimes that is missing a bit more in modern comics, where you don't have as many thought bubbles or a bit of extra help to kind of guide you along and maybe not have to really look for it on the page. It kind of comes with it naturally, or kind of helps expand on what they're trying to show you, because sometimes, you know, whether the art is too bombastic or crazy or overdone, you're not quite understanding what they're trying to get across in this in a certain moment. So I do appreciate at times the extra little bit of narration to guide the reader along with some of it. The broken nature of some of it was kind of hard to get through at times, you know, like, suddenly we're doing all these things, you know, we're going to Man-Thing, and they introduce this random doctor who's about to commit suicide. Like, oh, what's this guy all about? No, he's just there for this one book for no real apparent reason. You're going to have, you know, skimpy Martha defeat the Lizard with a fire hose. Okay, sure. Like, some really awkward, like, interesting beats like that. So, like, it's like you never see that kind of stuff. Like, there's like, why are you introducing a character in here? I even get a whole panel of backstory about this guy and his brief, you know, roller coaster life of being this chemist, and everything went down, the stock market's divorced, wants to die. Okay, but why are you in this book? What are you leading me to later on? Are you going to be like in cahoots with the jackal down the road? I don't know, but nothing happened. Maybe there's something way, way down the road. I don't know if they're planting seeds now for 6 years later. I don't know. That stuff was a bit weird.
That's part of the recollected format, though. I mean, that's not necessarily, like, that's Giant Size Spider-Man is its own book, and like, Conway has to respect what's happening around it, but like, it's not necessarily part of the same. It's all also part of the same continuity, but it wasn't part of Conway's projection for what Amazing was doing. Okay. So at least not in the way that sometimes an annual would be. So that's more just, that's how we're modern collecting it, so that it's all in sequence. But in practice, that's not how the writer would have necessarily understood it. But you're right. It does kind of make it a little bit more staccato. To Nate's point earlier, the idea that we unfortunately never really get a sense of what Gwen is really feeling or thinking, like, outside of how Peter interprets it. There's a few fleeting moments. Like, there's a really sad moment where, you know, when he's less of a dick to her, and they're having a quieter moment walking together, and, you know, she's like, she has to think, and she's like, well, come here, I understand, I love you, don't I? And he's like, you, and she's like, you love me, but, like, wait a minute, maybe you don't. And just the look in her face, like, that's really upsetting and sad for this character, that, because as you said, Paul, like, she's acting, although this doesn't actually, not actually how clones work, but okay, in comic book clones, she remembers everything up to when, you know, shortly before Gwen died, so she thinks that her and Peter are together, and there's no reason she can imagine that that shouldn't be true. So it's really a sad moment when she realizes that, oh wait, maybe you don't love me. And then the shot of she goes into the apartment. Also, what apartment, where? Because, like, where does she have to live? But that's a whole other thing, because she lived on her own, and then she died, so, like, okay, where's her stuff? But you have the shot of Peter, with like an angry kind of like visual coloring effect around his head and him just punching his hand. And you can feel that moment. Like, again, there's a lot of very human things here. You can understand that this guy, as you mentioned, Paul, totally thought he was losing it and cracking up completely. And what I was mentioning to Nate before, we started reading here at 139. 136 and 137 is Harry Osborn goes crazy and becomes the Green Goblin. So, like, this just happened. So the idea that it could be someone out to get him is very realistic to him, because Harry just went to the insane asylum. Like, this is just right on the heels of this, right? Like, he's now in comic book terms, it's been publication-wise and retroactively, they've added it, that it's been 2 years since she died. That's arguable, because that had been true for the actual, like, sequence of comics, but not necessarily comic book time, but that's what they'll go with. But this is, like, this is this big moment. Now, the big thing I have a question for you guys about, you hear about this is the original Clone Saga. The Spider clone only shows up at the end of one issue and in one issue of his own, and then he's gone. That's it. Like, was that surprising or shocking to you guys at all? Like, did you expect that he was around more? Or, like, what did you know of how long he was actually here?
I guess I don't know if I would say surprised. I'm maybe a little disappointed, because as Zeb Wells told you, what did he accuse you of being? A Benhead?
A Benhead, yeah. We're all Benheads here.
I'm a Benhead myself too, so I'm the character I'm most anticipating. Hey, I'll say this. I really like how he's introed. I really like this out of nowhere, there's a panel of Peter kind of coming to on the floor, this is issue 149. And he says, "Wow, I feel like I've been stung by a hornet." And off panel, there's another word balloon that says, "Wow, I feel like I've been stung by a hornet," which is a nice little, it's a clue or a cue. And you turn the page, and then they're both almost positioned identically as they were sitting up. So the jackal positioned Ben in the same room on this theater, on this stage. So they both came to at the same time. I'm like, okay, that's a fun doppelganger moment. And then, who the heck are you, fella? And where's the jackal? I said that weird. But then the other guy goes, who are you, fella? And where's the jackal? So they're that kind of perfect mimic. That is horrifying and creepy and interesting, and it makes me think of, like, Labyrinth or something. It's an out-of-this-world moment where like a Doctor Who episode where something is just mimicking you perfectly and it's unsettling and they're saying what you're thinking. So this is signaling this is a perfect clone, right? This is a perfect copy. And perhaps even the reader might get confused from panel to panel about who's the right one. And that's a neat storytelling technique. Again, the camera, as it were, rotates around them, pans away, comes back, and now they're grappling. And so this is gutsy, like what they do by the end of it, right? Because when at the end they're the Gwen clone, he says, "I'm the real one, Gwen, believe me." And she goes, "But how can you tell?" And he goes, "Simple, far out." And he has a moment of doubt where he's just kind of like, this is a trip, man. Like, what if I'm questioning everything about myself? And how do I know I'm my real self? And he has this like very almost quiet existential moment. And then the reader gets to just fill in a lot of those blanks. And then, of course, there's that mysterious end page of him, of Mary Jane saying, he says, "Am I ever glad to see you, lady?" And she goes, "You mean a tiger for real?" And he goes, "Come here, I'll show you." And then closes the door, click, and you're not allowed to see what happens, at least not here. So there is so much going on that isn't really the clone, right? You've got the two women in his life vying for his affection. Mary Jane has a talk with May and says, "Right, I'm going to fight for what's mine." Got these pages at the hospital, right, where the classic soap opera, where one of them is almost in tears, thinking about how will Peter be mine, and the other one is, "Who am I really? And am I a real girl?" And stay tuned next month for more on this. There's so much happening, and then Peter kind of doesn't really know if he's real, and they go into the next issue. This is 150, and it ends with this ambiguous moment where Peter gets he has access to this DNA report about whether or not he's the real deal, and he decides, I beat Alistair Smythe, I beat this collection of recent foes, almost the new Sinister Six, so I've already got the answer. Because I can punch real good, I must be the real Peter Parker, and he throws the papers out the window. And so Terry Cavanaugh almost 30 years later, he's clearly obsessed with this because he brings it up at that meeting. Isn't that how the story goes? That Terry is the one?
Yeah, he's the one who brings it up 20 years later. And it was like, hey, we could do this thing. Now, in the meantime, I mean, first of all, crazy that he, had this in mind and was like, well, what about the clone? What if we do something here?
Yeah.
What is crazier...
Yeah, it's set up, it's left.
Yeah, there's so much dangling here. Again, we haven't talked about it, but, you have, him putting the extra body in the smokestack, which comes back in multiple ways in the 90s as well, because eventually there is a spider skeleton found in a smokestack. So, it's interesting for you guys, I would imagine, to having read all this, all the 90s material, and then going back and seeing all the origins of this. Like, oh, there's the smokestack. There's this. There's the test that Spider-Man threw away because he assumed that his love for MJ meant that he wasn't a clone. Like, all this stuff is there. What I find so fascinating going back and reading it as well is that you have those two epilogues to, 149. And obviously you mentioned the one with MJ, which is classically thought of as being when he consummated his relationship with MJ. For a lot of people, that's the moment for a lot of people.
Sure.
But also the page before is the Gwen clone just exits stage left and that's it, which is crazy.
It's like, I don't know what to make of myself. I'm going to go on a road trip. I'm like, again, there's so many shadows of what's to come, right? Because Ben is the clone that goes on a road trip. Mm-hmm. So she just kind of drifts away and I'm going to wander around. We just kind of passed by it really quickly, but Peter Parker, former teenage scientific prodigy, just dumped a corpse in a smokestack. Just kind of took off. Like, there's so much happening, and there's all this groundwork that they're setting these seeds down, and they leave and they move on, and that's the nature of comic books. But it is rife with moral questions, ethical questions, questions, existential questions. And so I think it's a reason why young Terry Cavanaugh was just like, this is stuck with me. I'm still thinking about this in the 90s, and they need a big swing. They want their own Death and Return of Superman. So what if we do that? And I love that swing they take in the 90s, and I love that it's fun. I think it's just it's fun despite the fact that we don't really get anything of the clone. And, of course, you know me. I am a Ben head, and so to me, I don't read these years between this storyline and and the 90s Clone Saga, and so I don't have the same affection for what I still see, regardless of retcons, is the clone who got out of the wreckage, went to go hang out with Mary Jane, and they did their thing, that was the clone, and the guy who said, that's wild, how do I know if I'm real or not? And he said, I love Mary Jane or whatever, and I'm going to throw those papers, and those papers said the entire time this was the clone, because the real Peter, now Ben Reilly, woke up and went on a journey. So that's still I love the gall of it all. I love the what they were going to do. And so it is probably, I don't know, in reverse order, like you said, how I read this, but I read Spider-Man 72, where you see, John Romita Jr., Onslaught and Impact issue, where Ben goes into that smokestack and there's that beautifully drawn John Romita Jr., really crusty, rough, skeleton, and I'm like, what the heck is this? So I absolutely did this in reverse order. So this was kind of like mining history for that kind of thing. So yeah,
I'll point out that Jerry Conway's last issue was 149. So he didn't even do 150 and 151. That's by Archie Goodwin. So you actually already have a different writer taking on. We talked, I think, off podcast, which we shouldn't do, but Ross Andrew started drawing Amazing Spider-Man at 125, so he was still relatively, I guess he was over a year in by the time we kind of picked him up here in 139. Paul, questions about, the Jackal that we know of now is a far cry from this gentleman here. Like, this is very different. Like, we're used to the 90s Jackal who's, genetically engineered his body for 5 years in, a weird tank. That the actual Miles Warren who died here was actually a clone of his. The actual Miles Warren is very different. This is a much more unhinged kind of crazy guy in a jumpsuit, murdering his lab assistant, and throwing him under the bus later. So, what are your thoughts on this interpretation of the Jackal? because the Jackal plays a lot bigger part here than the Spider Clone does, because he's the one kind of pulling the strings behind the scenes. He had actually already been introduced, I think, in issue 129 or so. He was the one who first brought the Punisher to fight Spider-Man. So you can thank the Jackal for a lot of things. But what was your take on this version of Miles Warren?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, I mentioned this to you the other day when I saw you. This is actually Mystique, because it's Dr. Adler from the X-Men animated series.
It's true. It looks like it.
That was the first thing I kind of looked at. So, you know, circling back a little bit to the point of, you know, the clone only being, like, in, like, you know, 8 pages at the end here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go as far back as to when he gets judo chopped in that apartment with the grizzly back in like 139 or whatever? Was that when he took Peter's DNA then to perhaps clone him? Or do you believe that it was when they took all those samples for the class that was the original kind of excuse?
I think that's
later
what
on in the stories, right?
Yeah, I think it's that he already had this DNA, and how he ended up with Spider-Man's is almost incidental. Like, he didn't necessarily know he was Spider-Man at some point, like when he got the DNA the first time. There's a lot of questions there that they just kind of don't want us to ask.
No, that's true.
What that lets you do, it was in a scene where he threatens to hit Gwen in the mouth, you could go, that was the clone the whole time. That wasn't real Peter, right? That's the magic of science fiction, of this serialized science fiction, right? You get to ask the questions and have the no prize, and that's fun.
But knowing how the story ends, so to speak, like when I first saw it happen and I see Peter pass out on the couch and there's Jackal dancing about and there's Grizzly, I go, okay, this is right here. This is where it all starts, right? And then we go on all these side tangents for 64 issues and then finally at the end we get this quick clone battle, right? So it's like, it's one of those things where you have like this movie and you're waiting anxiously for the climax to happen, and it's almost like what you get there is good, but it's so condensed. It's like, oh, I want to see more of that, you know.
You saw the sequel, like you saw many sequels, and they all reference this moment, and you're like waiting for that moment, and it was a very quick moment.
Yes, absolutely. The Jackal, obviously a very interesting take. You know, you have this take on this teacher who, I guess as the story goes, has this infatuation with Gwen, which is a little awkward. He's a much older gentleman, right? That's not an uncommon story trope, right?
It's the Professor X to Jean Grey.
Yeah.
You know, Spider-Man comics. How he invites a teenager in his house and goes, I must never let her know I love her. Like, okay, man, like, this is not ethical. You've got to stop.
Right? Because they even show, like, this awkward scene where she's, you know, comes out of the cloning of that, so to speak, and she's, you know, all there. And, you know, he's oogling. And, okay, do we need to see this happen right now?
Although 70s
haircut right away, right? Same thing with Wolverine. He always comes back with the same haircut, so even a Gwen clone with the bangs. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I will say
he had the hairband on too, like was there the black hair.
Maybe I don't know.
Like 70s nudity is very different because this is. I mean, they did this in an issue of Spider-Man and Smoke and Mirrors in the storyline in the Clone Saga. Sorry, the Clone Saga we popularly dealt with in the '90s, and it was much more sexual. Of Gwen walking out in, like, in terms of how they showed her body, it was almost more incidental here. Like, oh, she's out, like, which I found kind of quaint. Like, it wasn't as exaggerated in terms of the female form. But you're right, though. I wonder, could you do this storyline now, if this didn't already exist, with this character having an obsession over a very early 20s character and then cloning her? Like, that seems so much more problematic saying it out loud now than it felt probably in the 70s. It was kind of like this just, as you said, a trope of the time.
Yeah, if you roll it back, this is all pure mad science vibes, right? Like, it's just him, he's got his cloning, he's wearing a crazy green jumpsuit, he's somehow, he's a super old man, but yet somehow when he throws his suit, he's svelte, and he has trained his body to be this amazing fighter who can, you know, judo chop Spider-Man, take him out with his little poison-tipped, you know, fingernails and stuff. Like, there's a lot of, like, obviously, what we know how Spidey can react, and with this Spidey sense, like, he gets his butt kicked quite easily a lot in this era. Yeah. Right? He doesn't seem to be the same. And again, we can maybe buy into the fact that, you know, yes, you're 150 issues into this character, but he's still a young kid and learning how to be a hero and learning. Like, you never just trained for only how to fight, really, I don't think, in these early days, right? Maybe later on he hangs out with Elektra and Daredevil a bit more.
It's Iron Fist, right? In AVX.
Yeah, he...
Like, Iron Fist trains him. Or is it Shang-Chi? Is it Shang-Chi?
He's learned from both of them, but you're right. Like, Spider-Man's a very different character. Like, even in the issues with Mysterio, right, where he punches that wall and you see that shot of his hands all, like, gnarled up and, like, smashed. Yeah. Like, that, they don't really do that anymore with him. Like, they kind of paper over it and, like, oh, you know, he's injured. But, like, he seems to heal a lot faster, whereas here he feels more fallible. Even in the 90s, where you had, like, the, you know, Maximum Carnage, you kept having him, like, tape up his ribs and then, like, oh, I could, you know, I felt that move. I do feel like more modern comics just kind of lean into that heavy violence and not really showing the impact to his body anymore, whereas here you do see that. You see his crippled hands. Like, you know, things last longer. He does feel like more of an actual person in that respect, and not just like this crazy invincible superhero.
Yeah, because when he goes to town on that those mirrors and then starts pushing that wall, right? That fit of rage and hallucination. Those busted hands and him even reacting to not being able to jump or dodge as effectively, he's always going back to it. It lasts multiple times. We always think. I think it's been established that Spider-Man does have some level of accelerated healing, which is fine. But for them to kind of stick to it and be consistent is nice to see.
For sure. Well, I think, do you have any other additional thoughts before we kind of bring this episode to its close? I think, again, when we get into the next one, we actually start digging into the meat of the 90s. I think we'll have a lot more to say because everyone has their own personal interactions with the character over the years. But again, this was, for you guys, kind of a new experience. So I was just excited to listen to you guys kind of talk about what it was like to read this. Now, I guess the larger question is, outside of the Clone Saga stuff, did you have any interest after reading issue, like, 150 of reading forward? Would you want to read any more of the 70s? Or you're like, you know what, that was fun. Let's get back to the 90s.
Part of me wants to almost go back a little bit before, like I guess that's a coincidence that you see, right? Because, like, in jumping in at this point, right, I felt like, and again, I have no context to it, but I feel like, oh, did Gwen Stacy just die, like, 5 issues ago? Or was it, like, you said it was 2 years, so I guess it's a much bigger leap. But it's like, you know, again, just killing back these things that I've always known of the character but never actually read. So looking at some of those bigger touch points would be, you know, sort of curiosity just to give it a read, whether it's, you know, a quick one-issue thing or a multi-issue thing, that's fine. But yeah, this was fun. It was different. It was much different. It gives you a kind of a different perspective on, again, what these books were like at the time, and it really makes sense for it when you really think about how they were written and how they were showcased. So this was a lot of fun. I do like that we kind of got to go back and crack open a history book.
Yeah, I was happy to read it. I was mulling over ordering a copy of the Epic for this essential collection. Whether I want to have it on my phone, you're like, you know, as you are an enabler, Adam. You know you want it, you know you want to get it, you want to have it next to the other clone books, and I think I'm happy I didn't do that. I think I'm happy not to own it.
Mm-hmm.
Having seen the art, though, you know, it gives me pause. if the price was right. But for now, I'm just happy to have borrowed it and read it, but it's not something I feel I need to have on my shelf in the same way that the, you know, the 90s Clone Saga. I want to get those. I guess, again, I'm going to collect them again in Epic format because that's what we do. So thanks for the opportunity to read it. But I don't think that I would want to read before or read after. I'm still not there yet with 70s Spider-Man. I know you want to convert me. I'm still more of a 70s X-Men guy than Spider-Man. But
well, I do like that this isn't nearly as wordy as what Claremont does in the early days of X-Men. Like, this is at least... Some of it I'm reading, like, 3 essays to get through a page, whereas there's a lot of words here, but I feel like I can get through it a lot easier. One thing I wanted to ask, though, really quick, though, for 150, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he has this little gauntlet with these other villains, right, that all poof to smoke. So is he, like, dreaming this whole time that these random battles throughout the street? Because he kind of has the test, passes out, and lays down, as you see in the first couple of panels,
mm-hmm.
and then he, like, you believe he startles away because the vulture just happens to be screaming out the window. So he goes to fight them and has this weird gauntlet, but everyone poofs away. And at the end, when he defeats the Spider Slayer, there's a really quick sliver of panel where he's just like standing up, where maybe he could have woken up at that point. Then he takes a flip of the folder, and then that's it. So, like, what happens here, boys?
Well, hold on. When he's fighting all these guys, isn't the Spider Slayer almost immediately there? Like, wasn't it all a gauntlet by the Spider Slayer? Like, wasn't that what was happening? Like, he fought each one in succession, and he was exhausted by it, and he was about to walk away, and he thinks it's a dream, and he turns around, and then there's the Spider Slayer.
Yeah, so is the Spider Slayer causing all the illusions?
Yes.
He explains it, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think it does. He keeps thinking it's just a recurring nightmare, but then he realizes it is.
He says they're humanoid robots that self-destruct whenever he beats them.
That's right.
So it looks like they vanish, but he's just made robots, and then they poof because they burn up so completely, so quickly that it tricks Peter.
That's
plus all the mind games that are happening anyway. So they're just robots.
I mean, Smythe is lucky that he happened to be coming to Spider-Man on a day where he's, even more so than usual, having an existential crisis.
yeah, he's all messed up.
Tuesday for Peter.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I must have rushed through the reading up to catch that, but thank you for the clarification.
I would find it interesting at some point, not connected to what we're going to be doing for the next year on the Clone Saga, but it would be interesting to have you guys, jump forward in time and, read... early Hobgoblin stuff to see. I mean, that'd be like John Romita Jr., so it'd be early John Romita Jr., not later. So that's a very different version of John Romita Jr., but it'd be interesting to see how you guys, if we kept jumping ahead like 100 issues at a time, just to see what you guys would think about the stylistic changes as we move through the decades with Spider-Man, because you don't really have much grounding in that period.
Yeah,
that's where Ned here leads to, right?
No.
Actually, no.
I mean, he's not the actual Hobgoblin. That was just one.
No, but he's part of that storyline.
I mean, yeah, okay. Later, he's there at the tail end of the Hobgoblin saga when it gets all complicated. But at the beginning, he's not really around.
Okay.
It should have been Kingpin's son. It should have been the original plan. I think it makes so much more sense. Instead of the Rose, you have him as the actual, Hobgoblin. But what can you do, right? It was a debacle. But yeah, Ned's involved, but it's not really him. And it's Roderick Kingsley, but wasn't really supposed to be.
That was. Yeah. It was supposed to be Kingsley. Always supposed to be Kingsley.
No, but it was supposed to be the Rose.
No, that was not Stern. Are you talking about Stern? Oh, Stern wanted it to be his own dude that he'd already introduced.
Okay, well, if not Stern, then who am I talking about? Because originally it was supposed to be end up, because it was all these clues.
Yeah, DeFalco.
What's Wilson Fisk's son's name? What's his first name?
Richard,
yeah, that it was supposed to be that was the way things were set up.
Correct.
And then it goes and bounces and bounces and bounces. And I just think, based on the way that was set up, I mean, and it would be really cool, actually, to have, this maniacal marauder be gunning after the Kingpin and also trying to, mess with Spider-Man. There's just something about that relationship. As soon as I heard that was the original plan, I was like, that's perfect. I'm like, I don't care about a fashion mogul. I don't care about, Ned going crazy. Like, that's what I wanted, but it doesn't matter. It's fine. But yeah, those aren't in epic form yet, right? We have some of the later, exiting of that, those volumes, but we haven't been able to collect. I haven't been able to collect those in hand. So when those start coming out physically, I would be happy to talk and do that read of the Hobgoblin saga.
Yeah. It'd be fun. I mean, yeah, there's some of the DeFalco Friends stuff is in the Ghost of the Past epic. Kind of the mid to late version of their run.
Yeah.
Like, I have a lot of general collections that have, I think it's just called the Origin of the Hobgoblin trade, which is a nice big thick trade, but it jumps around a little, so it's not a proper epic. And then I also have the complete Black Costume period. And they have two giant trades for that. So, I mean, eventually when the epics come, they'll kind of retire those books. I won't need them on the shelf as much, but there are ways to experience the material. I know you're waiting for the epic, so you may have a couple of years to wait still. But yeah, no, I think that'd be a lot of fun to jump through the decades with you guys. Because again, I think what might blow your mind, Paul, is to read 60s Spider-Man, because it's Peter's an asshole a lot. Like, he's not necessarily that nice a guy back in the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, like even in the era where you see like Batman slapping Robin and Superman doing all kinds of terrible things to Jimmy Olsen,
maybe not that bad. But even his first like appearance in his book proper, right, with the Fantastic Four, he's like, "Make me a member." They're like, "Who are you?" He's like, "Take some webbing." Like, he's just kind of a jerk a lot. So I've been seeing him. You know, I remember reading him like that too at the time. So
he just needed to get paid. Like, he just wanted...
I mean, yeah, that's his origin story. He's a jerk. He's like, some criminal is stealing money. He's like, not my problem, buddy. Like, he... Right? So it's like he learned with great power comes great responsibility, but you don't always have to be nice. Like, it's still okay to be a jerk when you feel like it, I guess.
What would Uncle Ben say?
Give that kid a fat lip.
Uncle Ben would say, please don't shoot me.
Aww.
He would say.
All right, well, guys, thank you so much for being part of this. And again, we're going to go through the 90s Clone Saga next, which will take a long time because there's a lot of content. But I'm glad that you guys now have more of a grounding on the 70s version of Spider-Man and the original Clone Saga with all, what, 5 pages of Ben Reilly in his glory. And then Terry Cavanaugh, man, that guy, we owe him a debt of gratitude that he was like, well, hold on. Yep. What about the clone?
Yeah. Hey, if I ever get to meet him, that'd be great. At a con or something, we should, like, you know, buy him a beer or something, or tip of the hat, or, I mean, I don't know, I don't love everything he's done, but I love that. I love that idea. It's a great idea.
For sure. All right, well, thanks a lot, guys, and to the listeners, you can email us at comicshenanigans@gmail.com, write the show on iTunes, subscribe to us on iTunes, and listen to us on Spotify. Thanks again for joining us, and bye-bye.